From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 5th in Cleveland, Ohio. It was halftime at a game between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Atlanta Hawks. Cavs star forward Kevin Love had been feeling stress from a number of things going on in his life, some on the court, some off. His team was struggling. He had some issues with his family. He says he wasn't sleeping well, and he had no idea what was about to happen. Love came out for the third quarter, and everything felt off. He said he felt like his brain was trying to climb out of his head, like maybe he was about to die. Kevin Love is experiencing what he calls a panic attack, an anxiety attack. He had to leave the game. He told almost no one for weeks, but that changed last week when Kevin Love opened up about his struggles in a piece for the Players Tribune online. It was titled, "Everyone is Going Through Something." Love thought it might be helpful to share his own experience as a way of reducing the stigma, and maybe, he thought, a few people would be more comfortable in sharing their own stories. As it turns out, Kevin Love's piece has helped spark thousands of stories. He's had emails, tweets, more than he can even see or read, handwritten letters, and he credits another star athlete, Toronto Raptor star DeMar DeRozan, who had just recently opened up about living with depression. Well, Kevin Love said until seeing DeMar DeRozan, he didn't know if he could write that piece. But he credits DeMar DeRozan's openness for this. U.S. ski racer Michaela Schifrin opened up about her battle with anxiety, saying during the Olympics, it's been creeping up more and more, and she's decided to see a psychologist about it. She has no problem talking about it. Well, this hour, we want to have a conversation about beating back the stigma of mental illness. And what can we do to make sure everyone feels comfortable talking? Let's talk about it this hour with our guests in studio. Christina Mosgraber is back, events coordinator and walk manager for the National Alliance on Mental Illness Rochester chapter. Great to have you back here.
Thank you.
Also back with us is Melanie Funches, Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. Melanie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio is Desiree Pernicelsi, a teacher at Greece Olympia High School, coach of the girls' soccer team and girls and boys' track and field team. Is that all, Desiree?
Yes, that's it.
Nice to have you. Thank you
for
being
much.
Here. And Stephen Moisofsky is here. How did I do, Stephen? Moisofsky.
Pretty good. You got it.
Stephen Moisofsky is a lifelong OCD and anxiety sufferer who just recently I had a chance to see Stephen perform with my colleague Mona Isler on stage and did a wonderful job in an improv comedy show. Outstanding work there. And it's great to have you here. Thanks for being here to share your story.
Thank you.
I want to start by reading a little bit about what Kevin Love wrote. But first, I want to listen to some of the remarks from a couple of athletes. Let's listen first to DeMar DeRozan, who came out a couple of weeks ago, started talking about depression. He actually started tweeting about depression getting the best of him again. And people started asking him, and he said, I'm going to talk about it now. This is Toronto Raptors star DeMar DeRozan talking about his own depression.
You know, I know a lot of people ashamed to talk about it. You know, even myself for a long period of time, you know, people wonder why I was such a quiet guy, you know, and that was part of it, you know, not wanting to speak out about it, not wanting other people to know exactly what I was going through. But, you know, you get to a certain age and, you know, where you feel like it's all about helping others. It's not about you just being a selfish person about the things you're going through, other people going through stuff as well. You know, if you could share that and put that on the forefront, it may could help somebody, whether if it's one person or 100 or 1,000, you know, and I just finally got to that point to where, you know, it's time for me to say something.
And now let's listen to Kevin Love talking about having written that piece, having seen DeMar DeRozan come out with his story, writing the piece for the Players Tribune called Everyone is Going Through Something. Kevin Love talking about the response from the public and the thousands of emails, tweets, and letters he's gotten.
I didn't realize that the response would be like it was or like it is. It's amazing what you know, we're able to do with this platform. But like I mentioned, everybody's going through something, and everybody you know, has things that you can't see, you can't touch, that you know, they're walking around with every day. So just, I remember talking to my agent. I had showed him you know, kind of what I had wrote, and he said, you know, I understand what you're doing, and we both agreed that even if you're able to help one person and one person not, you know, live with the stigma of thinking it's weird or different to have, you know, certain issues, you know, every single day, that, you know, this is going to be an amazing thing. But the response had been really overwhelming. I sent out a tweet yesterday when we were in the air saying, email me at my Players Tribune address, and you know, we've got over a few thousand emails now of people responding with their stories and, you know, coming out and say this really helped them.
So that's DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love, and let's go around the table and get the some response on the power of people with platforms opening up about their struggles. Christina Mosgraber, what do you make of what you heard?
I just think that's so awesome. I've been, you know, following all this, and one thing that really resonates with me is the way they said, if I can help one person, you know, if you can make a difference with one person. And that's, I think, a message that universally we can all relate to, you know, by opening up and talking about it, helping one person, and then the ripple effect it has, you know, and that just resonates. There's no message of, you know, I'm out here trying to save the world. It's I'm honest, I'm open, and if I save and help one person, and we know it's going to be more than that. But I just love that grassroots message of let's talk about it and help who we can.
Melanie?
I agree. I also feel like speaks to like. And for athletes in particular who are on this platform, a lot of young people particularly look to athletes. And for them to say, look, just like everybody else, I'm going through something. If I can help one person to say that I'm regular, just like everybody else, even if you see me, it looks like I can fly with a basketball, or I can, you know, run super fast, or whatever you think my extraordinary ability is, I still have this thing, you know. And I think that is an incredible message that we all go through stuff. It doesn't matter what other things you may have. We all go through stuff, and I think it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, people looked at DeMar DeRozan and some of the early response to his tweet when he said depression getting the best of me. Some people wrote back and said, "You got a $100 million contract. What are you depressed about?" I think that really misses the point of depression, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, depression is when you have this overwhelming thing, this overwhelming feeling that that transcends everything. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how many awards you may have. It doesn't matter how you may have the hottest babe on the, you know, in the place. But none of that matters. You don't want to get out of bed, you know, or you may feel that it's that you there's all kinds of things that can happen because it's different for different people. But what we have to remember is that just like our identity is not wrapped up in stuff, the way we feel about our identity is not wrapped up in stuff.
Desiree, what did you make of what you heard from the athletes there? And get right on the microphone for me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was incredible that an athlete in that platform was able to step up. And I don't think people really understand how much of an impact they can make when they open that door. You know, open the door and stop pretending that it doesn't exist. You know, we just keep closing it off and boxing ourselves in, and we don't realize how much we limit ourselves when we do that. And when one person opens the door, they often don't realize it opens thousands of other doors. And if it doesn't open doors, it opens windows. And one way or another, that light is able to come in, and it changes people's lives in the biggest and the smallest ways, and change is the most important thing. So I am dumbfounded and completely humbled that these athletes are opening up and doing it, and I think it's incredible.
Stephen, for someone like you who's a lifelong OCD and anxiety sufferer, does it help seeing people in prominent positions opening up about their own stories?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the biggest pieces of what he was talking about is that everyone is going through something, so it's the kind of attitude we should all try to cultivate with each other, you know, because, you know, just because someone, you know, might not be able to, you know, you might not be able to see what they're going through, you really don't know what's going on. And I think we treat each other in a way that we just assume, hey, this person's great, this person has money, why should they be depressed? Or, you know, for me, I know it's a medical condition, so it's not like, it's just like anything else. You're coping with it, you're dealing with it, based on, you know, what your doctors are telling you to do and things like that. So it's very powerful when someone like that steps up, and hopefully it will kind of illuminate and hopefully get people to think more about, hey, you know what, maybe instead of being a jerk to that person that is, you know, driving erratically, maybe they're going through something, maybe they just lost someone, maybe they, you know, they lost a job and, you know, they're upset. So hopefully it'll make us a more empathetic society.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. And I see the phone ringing already. Listeners, if you want to share your stories, if you are feeling more comfortable about talking about your own struggles or challenges, everyone is going through something. And I think that's true. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. DeMar DeRozan talking about his depression, hasn't gotten overly specific, but is willing to say, I've lived with this for years, and that basketball is sort of an escape for me, but a $100 million contract doesn't make that go away. Kevin Love wrote very specifically, and what I want to do is quote from his piece, because I was moved with how specific he was willing to be about what happened to him, and we'll talk about this. Kevin writes this in his piece for the Players Tribune, quote, "Then came the panic attack. It happened during a game. It was November 5th, 2 months and 3 days after I turned 29. We were at home against the Hawks, 10th game of the season, and a perfect storm of things was about to collide. I was stressed about issues I'd been having with my family. I wasn't sleeping well. On the court, I think the expectations for the season were weighing on me. I knew something was wrong almost right after tip-off. I was winded within the first few possessions. That was strange. And my game was just off. I played 15 minutes of the first half and made one basket and two free throws. After halftime, it all hit the fan. Coach Lou called a timeout in the third quarter. When I got to the bench, I felt my heart racing faster than usual. Then I was having trouble catching my breath. It's hard to describe, but everything was spinning, like my brain was trying to climb out of my head. The air felt thick and heavy. My mouth was like chalk. I remember our assistant coach yelling something about a defensive set. I nodded, but I didn't hear much of what he said. By that point, I was freaking out. When I got up to walk out of the huddle, I knew I couldn't re-enter the game, like literally couldn't do it physically. And the coach came up to me. I think he could sense something was wrong. I blurted something like, I'll be right back, and I ran to the locker room. I was running from room to room like I was looking for something I couldn't find. Really, I was just hoping my heart would stop racing. It was like my body was trying to say to me, you're about to die. I ended up on the floor in the training room, lying on my back, trying to get enough air to breathe, and the next part was a blur. Someone from the Cavs accompanied me to the Cleveland Clinic. They ran a bunch of tests. Everything seemed to check out, which was a relief, but I remember leaving the hospital thinking, wait, then what the hell just happened? End quote. That is a lot of detail. And Christina, how valuable is it to get someone who's willing to say, this is me, this is not abstract, this is something that you think life is easy or the money is there or the fame is there, that's me. What's the value in that?
I think the value of being open about it is huge. The fact that, you know, and even just in such detail how he talked about it. So not only has he opened up the door that, okay, you see that I'm this basketball player and I'm making all this money and stuff. He's saying, okay, I'm a person and this is what I'm struggling with. And then to give such detail to talk about it and to make that visualization for people, hugely helpful. I remember when I started struggling with my anxiety when I was a kid, going to the doctor and having all these tests done because they thought something was wrong with my stomach or something was wrong with my, you know, medically wrong with me. And so I can resonate with that. And I think so many people can too, especially when they're not sure what's going on with their mental health, but they're feeling all these physical feelings and all these things that go along with it. Or, you know, just even how he said that, you know, he felt, his mouth felt like there was chalk in it, all these different things. So by being that open about it, not only is he opening the door for people to say, wow, you know, I've experienced some of those things. It's just like me. But people may be able to, when they're going to talk to somebody, say, you know what? It really resonated to me what Kevin Love said about the way the room was spinning or about how he physically felt. This is the way I've been feeling. Can we talk about it? So I think there's huge value in being so open about it and being so descriptive about it and talking about it and not just in kind of an ambiguous way, but to really get down and say, hey, this is what really happened. You know, and I didn't find any of that triggering or traumatizing or anything like that. I found it very appropriate and very real. So,
You know, Melanie, in subsequent interviews, he said that there are moments before he decided to share it that he thought, should I be embarrassed about this? Like, I mean, like, this isn't supposed to happen. All of those things that are probably normal human emotions, because something is new or it brings not just anxiety, but you have fear that, could this happen again? What does it say about me? And then you start asking yourself, shouldn't I be stronger? Why is this happening? He said he experienced all of that, but then ultimately he decided, look, other people are sharing, and I see the impact, and I am, you know, I've got to do this. But what would you say to somebody who may have those kind of symptoms but think, you know, I'm scared. I'm not just scared for me. I'm scared to talk about it. I'm scared to be stigmatized like there's something, you know, wrong with me.
Well, excuse me. The first thing I would say is, having these challenges is not a moral failing. You did nothing wrong. It's something that happens. you know, because, and like I've said on this show before, when someone has diabetes, no one says, oh, look at those diabetics, you know, or those asthmatics. You know, no one does that, right? We just say, get them an inhaler. What do we do to support you? Let's get some insulin and let's get some dietary changes on the board, you know? But so the same thing is with these things. And what I love about what Kevin Love did, he painted a picture and provided language. He painted a picture and provided language, because a lot of times when we go through stuff, the reason we have a challenge in communicating is that we don't have language. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Love's his beautiful, and I don't want to say beautiful in so much that it was a great thing, but in his, he painted a picture and he provided language. So if you have some 15-year-old kid somewhere who's saying, you know, my mouth felt like chalk, that's it. That's what, I didn't know how to say it. Or someone says, you know, I felt like my brain was trying to crawl out my head. Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. And it not only says that somebody else felt it and you are not alone, but it provides you language to ground it in something. And so my thing is, I would say to someone, A, this is not your fault. You did nothing wrong. You are not, it doesn't, your, this is not have anything to do with your strength, with your competence, with your intelligence, with your ability to negotiate life. This is just something that has happened. And then make use of the language to understand that no matter what, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, the athlete, we all go through this. You are not alone. So please step out. And if you didn't have words, borrow Kevin's. Borrow mine. But the key is to come out and let people know so that we can support you.
In a moment, we're going to go to your phone calls. Tracy, Manon on the phone. Stephen is going to have a chance to share a little bit about what he has worked through. And I think there's such power there. I want to ask Desiree, who teaches not only at Greece Olympia, but also coaches girls soccer, girls and boys track and field. Now, I was a young athlete, not a good one, growing up, and I was embarrassed enough about a heart condition that I didn't know was a condition. I was getting tachycardia incidents, and I thought, well, that's what happens to athletes. But I was so embarrassed that I didn't tell anybody until I collapsed on a basketball court. And I can't imagine what it must be like for young students, athletes who are dealing with, or just students in general, dealing with mental health, saying, well, I don't know what this is. If I was embarrassed about a heart thing, you know, I get that kids can be embarrassed. And what I would hope is that Melanie's words, Christina, the words of these athletes, the words of these prominent people can encourage people. Embarrassment should be gone.
Yep.
No shame,
absolutely.
No embarrassment, you know, nothing.
Yep.
How do we get there?
I think we continue the conversation. I think that adults that have a platform such as myself and the other people sitting around the table need to go into coaching or go into teaching, having this conversation, being upfront about it, just as much about how much water you should drink while you're performing on the sports field. Your ability to take care of yourself both physically and mentally are just as important when you're performing on the sports field. And having coaches and having teachers and having other adults have the conversation with kids that we've experienced these issues, athletes have experienced these issues, this is not something that we should be sweeping under the rug or pushing off to the side or holding back on anymore. Because the truth of the matter is there are kids that are suffering, that are afraid to speak up and are afraid that saying there might be something wrong with them is going to limit them, you know, on the playing field or in the classroom or in the workforce. And, you know, Kevin coming out and saying something shows us that it's not a death sentence. You know, it is not an end to your ability to be an athlete. Is it something you're going to have to work through? Yeah, maybe harder than other people, but it's never anything that's going to stop you unless you don't speak up about it. Then you'll find that you'll be held back.
All right, let me grab a couple phone calls, and we'll get Stephen's story as well. This is Manon first on the phone. Go ahead, Manon. Are you there, Manon? Go ahead.
Hi, this is Manon. Hi, everyone. I have been teaching 3,000 students around the world for the last 30 years. I've traveled, and I have a lot of experiences with students. So I just wanted to make some comments that would be very helpful. First of all, America has a very high level of stress. It's a very stressful society, and people have poverty, they have racism, they have so many issues to deal with, high cost of living, financial aid in colleges. So the stress actually contributes to all this mental health or mental problems. Secondly, I'd like to say there are examples of people who work very hard, let's say in the music industry, or people like Christina Onassis, famous people, and Whitney Houston. These people are musicians or athletics. These people have a lot of stress on their body. And mental illness, a lot of drugs, alcohol, and different things that contribute to mental illness. And thirdly, Evan, I'd like to really suggest to everyone in America and in your program to read Our Despotic Laws Destroy the Right to Self-Control. The article is by Dr. Thomas Sayles, and it's an incredible article on the, you know, psychiatric industry, medications, side effects of medications that cause hallucinations and harm to the body. And there are better ways to relieve stress, like getting help from counselors or, you know, getting into teamwork and other things that we can do.
Thank you. I was not aware of the article. We will try to look it up and figure out if we can track that down, and we'll share that with our guests if we can find it for you, Dr. Thomas Sayles. Thank you for that, Manon. And Tracy in Rochester also wants to weigh in and share her experience as well. Go ahead, Tracy.
Hi, Evan.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I'm really glad to get to be on your program. I'm going to read something because my mouth is like chalk, and I have anxiety when I speak.
Okay, no problem.
I'm a 70-year-old successful woman, a previous nurse midwife, and a master's degree in addiction counseling. I just accepted the diagnosis of bipolar 1 after years of depression, inherited from my mom who committed suicide because drugs weren't available back then. I've tried all kinds of meds. Sometimes they worked, but I always tried to get off them because of the stigma. Finally, I'm on the proper mixture of meds, and I'm becoming able to function better in this crazy world, which was just talked about. I just want to advocate for medication and psychiatric care and encourage people to work on getting over feeling stigmatized, because we are accepted. I feel accepted now.
Tracy, thank you. Can I ask you, are you comfortable with me asking you a follow-up question?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, you said you feel, you said, quote, we are accepted now. And I'm curious to know when that shift in feeling occurred for you, and why, if you're able to sort of figure out why that has changed.
Well, it's changed just recently because of more attention to mental illness and more counselors and people who work with people with mental illness coming out and saying, you know, this is a chemical brain disorder. It's a disease, and we need to treat it. And if we don't pay attention to mental illness in our society, things are going to get worse and worse.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you for calling this program and sharing that story, and I'm really honored you did that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Melanie Funches, does that give us more reason? That's just one person's story. Mm-hmm. And for every Tracy, there may be others who feel like they're not quite ready to share it, or they still struggle with stigma. We know stigma is still a problem. It's not over yet. But does that story at least give us some hope that we are moving a little on this?
I would like to hope so. But as with any movement, you take steps forward, you take steps back. You take steps forward, you take steps back. But as long as we are making a progressive movement toward understanding that we're all going through something at some point in time, and that we all are in need of support. And the thing I want to point out is that there are many, many different ways that people receive support. For some people, talk therapy and medication works. For some people, it's medication without the therapy. For some people, it's group things. For some people, they've taken, you know, they see naturopaths, and other people do, you know, yoga, meditation, mindfulness. The key that I want people to understand is that if you feel this, it's okay to say something, because there is a plethora, I mean, like a whole shopping mall full of stuff that approaches to being well. But you can't. My mother used to say, closed mouth doesn't get fed. You know, if you don't say something, we don't know how to support you. And it's okay to say something. And that's the one thing, if you don't get anything else out of my time being here, that it's okay. And I want people to know that you're not alone and that all of us go through something and it's okay to say something about it.
Hmm. Christina, what do you make of that phone call we got from Tracy?
I think that's incredibly brave. I'm so honored that I could be a part of that and a part of her sharing that story. I meet people all the time who will say something like that to me, you know, on a one-on-one basis. You know, they'll hear my story or, well, you know, I'll open up and they'll come open up. But to go on the radio, especially yes. a live radio program and be that brave is just incredible.
Awesome.
And I think every single person who opens up to talk about it again, whether it's one-on-one or it's on the radio or it's, you know, in a chat room or a blog or any way that you communicate and connect, that's brave, whatever it is. And for however long it is, I've met people who, you know, want to start talking about it and then they realize, you know what, I need some more time. And that's okay.
Yes,
it is important to meet everybody where they're at. We're all different. You know, keep that in mind. Keep an open mind. If somebody mm-hmm. says, hey, I want to talk about it today, but then tomorrow they're not feeling up to it, it's okay.
Yeah.
I work with students all the time that, you know, they may be ready and then they're not ready, and that's okay. So we need to meet people where they're at, but that was incredibly brave, and I agree completely with everything Melanie said, too, about, you know, and that's something we work hard, especially with the kids, is what works for, you know, your friend might not work for you. I always give the analogy, you know, I tried group therapy once, I left halfway through, I was terrified. But one mm-hmm. of my best friends, he loves it. So with young people especially, we work so hard to make sure they know there is that shopping mall. Even if they think it's just Amazon, there is a shopping mall of resources out there to help them find what they need. But that's incredible. I am absolutely moved by that phone call. That is so
absolutely.
Brave to do that.
Let me turn to Stephen Wojcicki to kind of talk a little bit about his own personal story as an anxiety sufferer. That when's the first time in your life that you would have been able to say, yep, I'm an anxiety sufferer? When were you really aware of it?
Probably as far back as I can remember, like in childhood, you know, so I'm talking, you know, the course of my entire life. And growing up, it wasn't really, you know, I grew up in a time, I guess, where medicine still looked at things as sort of like, well, you know, I remember being taken to doctors, they're like, the kid's just really shy, he's really quiet, you know. But it wasn't until like my early 20s that, you know, after some episodes and things like that, where, you know, there was kind of like a formal diagnosis at that point. So, I mean, it took, you know, literally, you know, 15, 16 years to kind of get to that point. And I mean, a lot of what everyone's, you know, has said and, you know, the people that have called in, if you take anything away from it, it's again, it's not something that is wrong with you. You know, it's a condition or it's circumstances that you're dealing with. I read a great book, you know, and I still kind of read it all the time, but it's called You Are Not Your Brain. And it kind of describes like how, you know, essentially a lot of these things that come up are just not, it's just your nervous system just working. And we tend to try to judge that or identify it as, well, that's me, you know, and that brings on further judgment from yourself, further shame, further, and that kind of drives people into this isolation, which is the worst. For any kind of condition, physical, mental, spiritual, any isolation is the worst. One of the things that helped me out is I found a lot of online support groups when I was really, really sort of afraid. I didn't want to really talk to people in person. And there was a sort of anonymity about that where, you know, I could share my story, could listen to other people talk about what they were going through. And that started kind of this little spark saying, well, you know, it's not just me. It's not just me that's going through this. And, you know, slowly I worked into, you know, doing like in-person support groups. There's a support group that I actually help run now through Meetup that we meet, you know, weekly and things like that. And lots of people come in. Lots of people stay for one meeting. Lots of people, you know, want to meet more than once, you know. So it's kind of like it just trying to get out of yourself is like the biggest thing because – you know, especially with how anxiety works, it's a very sort of like, hey, you're doing this, it's your fault, you're not a good person, and that just doesn't lead to anything more than feeling worse, you know, than you were already feeling. So
was there a particular incident that stands out to you as maybe the worst among them?
In my lifetime, I probably, you know, there's probably been, you know, a couple of major incidents like that in my life. I had extreme panic disorder when I was a sophomore in college, where it was more like agoraphobia, where I couldn't, as soon as I left my house, I just started sweating like crazy. My heart started racing. I started, you know, getting really nauseated. So anywhere I would go where I was kind of outside of my comfort zone, I had these strong sort of anxious reactions. So that was kind of like the first major thing that, you know, helped kind of identify that it's not something that was really like physically wrong with me, because again, I went through a lot of things, medical tests, all that. There was nothing, but there was a connection in how my nervous system was processing things and maybe the way it's kind of set up that made those, you know, those anxious feelings much more powerful, much more real. So there shouldn't be any shame. I mean, it's just like anything else, you know, that you have to experience in life. And if you need help with your math homework, you'd go ask someone to go, you know, help you with your math homework. This is kind of like that, but, you know, I think we still have that idea that it's sort of related to the person and how they deal with things, which is, it's just a false idea.
Are you, and Stephen's got to go in just a second, so let me kind of tie up your story. And I'm glad to see how well you're doing, I'm curious to know if you feel more comfortable now talking about it than in previous years of your life, and do you ever fear that you will be judged or sort of treated unfairly, either in a work setting or otherwise, because of it?
It's a hard thing to really talk to people about. Yeah. You know, I don't really, I mean, the reason I came on here was more or less because I've had more of a feeling that I really kind of want to have people be more aware that there's people out there doing things, living normal lives, while still having to deal with this. So there's a sense of maybe I've gained the courage enough to do that, but it's a hard thing to discuss, like with people at work or in professional settings, because, you know, I might understand, like, if someone comes up to me and says, hey, you know what, I really have this shopping addiction. I shop all the time and I spend a lot of money. I'm like, well, you know, there's help for that. But I don't think there's that same sort of, I don't feel like there's that same sort of system or at least mindset in place where I could go up to, you know, a coworker or a boss and say, hey, you know, I'm really struggling with my anxiety today. I can't really do my job well.
Do you not talk about it as a result, or do you now talk about it more?
I don't talk about it. I'm very selective, you know, to people I talk to, especially in professional settings. Outside of that, not so much, but.
Do you feel like in the future, whatever your employment situation is, you're going to be able to address this head on with people who are your colleagues, with your superiors, that this is something that's part of you and that you will not have to hide it?
I think so. I mean, I've come to accept it as being a part of myself and not something that I tend to. I mean, there was a big portion of my life where it was, you know, something I really hated about myself because it caused so much distractions, so many, you know, complications in my life. And ideally, yeah, I would hope that someday people can just, you know, just the same way that, you know, you call your supervisor or your manager and say, hey, you know what, I have a fever today. You can tell them, hey, you know what, my anxiety has been acting up really, really bad, or I'm feeling really, really depressed, or, you know, however, whatever mental, you know, conditions or symptoms you're having at that point. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, we really still don't treat illnesses in the mind the same way we do as the body. And it's until we get to that point, I think we'll still have people sort of suffering in silence, which is a horrible, horrible thing to go through.
Well, I know you got to run, but Stephen Moisovsky is here because I got to meet him, just last week, I think, a couple Mondays ago, performing with the Taco Vendetta, which is the improv group, and did a wonderful job there. And producer Megan Mack, who puts that group together, coaches that group, was talking just about how impressed she is with you. And I really admired you for sharing the story and kind of shining a light on not only your own challenges, but also some of the successes and things for all of us to think about. So good luck to you.
Thank you very much. And it's all Megan's credit. She's a great, Great teacher.
We say that every day here. She never listens. She never listens. Stephen Moisovsky, okay. Off you go. Thank you. Thanks for being here. We're going to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls. We've got more listener feedback to share with you. And we're talking about not just the stigma of mental illness and challenges like everything from depression to anxiety and panic disorders and related issues, but we're talking about how to share, how to feel comfortable doing that, how to make sure those around us feel comfortable and not stigmatized. So you heard Stephen's story, and we're going to come back and talk to our guest in studio. Desiree Pernicelsi is a teacher at Greece Olympia High School and coach of the girls' soccer team and girls and boys' track and field team. Melanie Funchess is director of community engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester, and Christina Mosgraber is events coordinator and walk manager for NAMI Rochester. Let's get right back after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. Do you want to see your doctor in person? What about telemedicine? We're going to talk about trends in the industry and the ways we interact with our doctors. In our second hour, the Black Cinema Series has a piece on Recy Taylor. It's a name you might have heard at the Golden Globes when Oprah told her story. We'll talk about the rape of Recy Taylor Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'll get back to your emails in a moment. Let me grab a phone call, and this is Angela and Victor. Go ahead, Angela.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
After the mass shootings, instead of saying maybe we should ban these assault weapons from our society, part of the NRA script now is to say, no, let's make sure that mentally ill people do not get their hands on weapons. And I particularly find this offensive because I have a son who served his country beautifully and who got decorated for it. He got PTSD, and now he is on medication, and he's doing very well. But as soon as people find out that he has problems this way, he kind of gets shut out of things. He has an MBA, and he has a master's degree in international relations. Very bright fellow. So I'm very upset that the NRA is trying to pin mass shootings on the mentally ill. And I guess that's what I have to say.
Angela, thank you. Let me kind of go around the room on that. Melanie Funchess, what do you make of it when we talk about the mentally people with mental illness as if they are inherently more dangerous when we know they are more likely to be victims of violence?
That's it. The data does not bear it out. 96% of all violent crimes that are committed in the United States are committed by someone who has no history of mental illness. 96%. If you take 100 and you minus 96, that leaves only 4%, right, of all violent crimes committed. And so the data doesn't bear this out, you know, and I know people try to do it because it sounds a certain way, but we know that people with a mental health challenge are 12 times more likely to be the victim of a violent crime than the perpetrator of one. The data does not bear it out. Now, people can say they feel, they believe, but I know because the data says so that this is poppycock. I mean, I can't think of a better word right now, but that's my word.
Okay. Christina?
I agree completely. I mean, Melanie stated the facts as we all know them to be. And that's, again, those are nationally known facts. You know, those aren't something that we just, you know, say to sound good. I mean, they're the truth. That's the research. And
it ain't fake, y'all.
That's right. It is true. And, you know, that I'm a big, you know, defer to the research person. But besides the fact that I, you know, my heart breaks for this woman who called in, that unfortunately that does all go back to stigma. A lot of it goes back to they hear that, you know, her son has PTSD and all they think about is the illness and not all these amazing things that make him who he is. And again, why we got to change this conversation.
Yeah, and Desiree, I think of the way we're forming minds and the way people understand society. So I think about students, and I think about if we are going to be more open to breaking down stigma, and as you said, talking more about it, and yet we're still having this conversation about guns, about mental illness, about who commits crimes, and if we allow people, especially young students, to think that mental illness equals maybe more likely to be a school shooter, more violent, when the data is not, as Melanie said, doesn't support that, then good luck for students who want to feel comfortable kind of coming out, having depression, talking about those issues mm-hmm. with their classmates, when their classmates may have the wrong ideas about what that means.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely creates an even larger struggle for the students that are sitting there thinking, what so-and-so just talked about, you know, I feel inside, but I'm not violent. You know, how do they feel comfortable sharing that? And I think that, you know, at least on my platform is we need to be transparent with these kids. We need to tell them that having a mental health issue does not define you. It is merely a piece of you, a part of you, just like your hair color. And share the facts with the students and tell them that these two things don't go hand in hand. They're not one and the same. And, you know, we're in this really scary time, unfortunately, to be in schools, but we're also in an incredible time. I work in an incredible district that allows transparency, and we talk about being mindful, and we talk about self-love, and we talk about learning about how important it is to get to know you, not what society thinks you should be. And I think that when we dig into those things and we admit that we need them in our schools, we can't just pretend that these things aren't going to go away. You know, when the first school shooting happened, in my mind as a student, I just imagined it never happen again. And now we've had countless acts of violence in schools, you know, over the past decade or so, and it's not going away. So what do we do about it? We talk about it. And we talk about what is fact, and we talk about what is not fact. And what is not fact is that people who suffer from mental illness ultimately resort to violence. That's not the case. And I think that when we dig into those issues and we teach children that they're two separate things, kids will feel more comfortable admitting that they might be struggling with something.
Yeah, and I know what some of our listeners are thinking because I've heard it before. And so let me just do a couple things because we're going to move the conversation to other parts here beyond guns. This week there is a planned school walkout for 17 minutes on the 14th to honor the victims at Parkland. We're going to be covering that. Next week we're going to be having a conversation on this program about a term that was coined in the Washington Post last week called gunsplaining. And it's the idea that if you support gun control but you don't own a gun, people who own guns are more likely to tell you that because you don't shoot guns and you don't know the terminology, you're not qualified to talk about policy. And and the writer of this piece basically said, I'm a veteran. I'm a gun owner. I think there is some merit that we all need to learn more, but I also don't think we should shut down the conversation just because I don't own a gun. And that's going to be a discussion next week. Then the following week, we're going to have a conversation about the National March that was planned by the students at Parkland. So there's a lot of different avenues for us to discuss these issues in the days to come, and I just want to thank Angela for the phone call on that. So, but I know, but where I'm going with this is some listeners are going to say, you're right, Evan. Melanie's right with that statistic. That having a mental illness makes you more likely to be a victim of violence. But what if you're in that small cohort that will become violent? What then? Well, there's a conversation about access to guns, number of guns in circulation. And that is, again, a separate conversation for a separate day, but I appreciate Angela's phone call. I want to get to a couple of other things. MJ writes to us and says the following. Wealthier people can afford better health care and better mental health care. The rest of us have to rely on spotty insurance coverage and therapists with long waiting lists for treatment. Sharing our stories is one thing, but having support is another, as it seems that so many people have problems these days that they may not want to be burdened by a friend's problem. They may not have energy to support someone because they are focusing on their own family problems. So MJ saying, Melanie Funches, we can share stories, we should break down those stigmas, but we still have big disparities in when it comes to healthcare, and it's usually income-based. Sometimes there's a racial component, as we know, so and we can't leave that out of this discussion. You agree with that?
Yes. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and give you a long answer when the answer is yes. At the same time, I also know that there are many things that are therapeutic that are not therapy. And I've said that here before. You know, this is not a plug, but at the Mental Health Association, we have a number of peer-run programs. We have our creative wellness studio where you can come and we use art as a medium for wellness. We have support groups. We have education for parents. We have a ton of stuff that's all free. You know, so our community, and I hear this a lot of times, and I get the snark thing. We are a resource-rich community, but it's true. There's lots of stuff in this community for people to reach out. And the thing is, your interpretation guides your intervention. How you think about a thing says what you do about a thing. If you feel that a therapist, a sit-down talk therapy is the only solution to relieving the challenges of mental illness, that's going to be the only thing you go to, and you're going to dismiss everything. But if we look at how do we find and maintain wellness, then it opens us up to a whole shopping mall, now that I'm coining this, a whole shopping mall of things that are available to us to help promote our wellness. So I would say to MJ, I think it was, mm-hmm. who said it, you know, yes, all the things you said are true. At the same time, yo, come check me out. Hit me up. Let's, you know, see if we can find one of our groups that may be That's able right. to help you. And I'm not saying that this is an alternative, but it could be very complimentary.
Okay. Jordan writes to us just sort of a good reminder of what can happen and how difficult it can be for people. Jordan says it's scary to share mental health stuff with your boss. It's really easy for your boss to start blaming everything on your mental health disorder. That happened to me. That's from Jordan. I'm certainly sorry to hear that, Jordan, and he is not alone in that. That has to change. That has to change. We have to be better with that. But thank you for the reminder because of how difficult it can be. And then we got an email from a listener named Philip who essentially said, I'm going to summarize Philip's email. He said, if you've got a treatable, diagnosable disorder, we should be sensitive to that. We should honor that. But he thinks that it's kind of a kids these days email. He thinks we are conditioning kids to find their own mental health problems where they might not exist. He thinks we shouldn't have things called mental health days, where you take a day off from work or school to sort of work on mental health. He thinks that by doing that, we are making kids, in his words, soft. I know you've heard this many times, Christina, whether this program or elsewhere, and Philip's view is he's not alone with this, so let's grapple with this. Are we creating a generation of kids to grow up, I think Philip used the word fragile. Let's address this. What would you say to him?
For sure. I would say that, you know, I respect everyone's thoughts and opinions and feelings, but for me, I say that I don't necessarily see that that's what's happening. I don't personally agree with that. And again, I'm going to go back because my best teacher has been my own personal experience. And I remember being a 10-year-old kid who didn't know what was happening to me. I was smart. I'm all these wonderful things that make me who I am, but I struggle with anxiety. I didn't know how to talk about it. My doctor didn't know what we were looking at. There were all these things happening, you know. So when I work with kids now, what we talk about is looking at your mental health just like you do your physical health. We teach them from a young age, eat your fruits and vegetables, go outside, exercise. Let's into the conversation. Okay, you know what? If you're feeling these feelings that are overwhelming to you, you're not able to concentrate, you're not able to get out of bed, let's talk about it. I don't think that it's necessarily creating a generation of making them fragile or less than or weak, which, you know, to me speaks to a stigmatizing, you know, language altogether. But I think it just makes us more aware. And I think it makes it more acceptable to talk about. The first thing I talk about in my lessons with kids, when I go in and work in the classroom, we talk about mental health. We talk about what you do to keep it feeling good and all the things. We talk about the difference between mental illness. And we talk about how your physical and your mental health is all connected. We raise awareness. We let them know the facts. You know, I've never had a kid raise his hand and say, oh my gosh, yep, you know what? That's exactly, you know what? I'm going to have depression today. That's what I want to be. That's who I am, you know? I think the conversation is helping kids understand what's going on with them at an earlier age. Again, to go from 10 to 34 years old without a diagnosis, struggling with, I wasn't sure what I was looking at and being able to fake it away and hide it. I'm happy we're talking about it with kids these days. Mm-hmm. So,
and Desiree, you talk to kids every day. What do you make of Philip's email that we're conditioning them to be, in his words, soft?
I think one of two things. I think that for the most part, in my experience being a teacher and a coach, that kids don't want to take on something that makes them different. They're not looking to take on more than they already have. And I think that we live in a difficult society, and they face enough outside stressors and pressure that they're not looking to take on something else so that they can stay home for 1 or 2 days from school. And I think that, you know, as an adult, you know, I'm a pretty well-adjusted adult in my career, and I value my work ethic and I value my career very much so. And there are days where the thought of going into work is too much to bear. And might I need a day off? Absolutely. I don't think that makes me weak. I think it makes me recognize that Sometimes you need to put pause on life and take care of yourself, and that you're stronger because of that, not weaker.
There's an endorsement for kids these days, not an attack on kids these days. Melanie, about 90 seconds left here. One of Philip's points was, don't we teach resilience anymore?
But part of resilience is knowing when to take a pause. That's how we build resilience. Because I would say that what we're saying, what Philip is saying, that the converse is true, that we are building strong, we're building better, stronger kids. Because wherein, when I was a kid, we weren't taught about how to be in touch with our feelings and how to know that it's okay to take a break. In us teaching our children about these things, they are able to be better and more proactive and be better stewards of their own health holistically. When I was training, I ran track, I played basketball. I knew when my muscles were dished out. I remember when my muscles were overtired. I knew when I was pushing beyond, and I knew what the signs were. So I knew when I needed to dial back my strength training. I knew when I needed to dial back my training. This is teaching kids how to be proactive and keep themselves well. Our children today deal with more stressors because they live in a 24-hour virtual environment where there is no turning it off. When I grew up, I walked in the house. TV went off where they played the Star Spangled Banner and you got fuzzy zzz sound. Our kids don't have that. They are tuned in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we need to be able to arm our children with strategies and coping mechanisms to build their resilience and build their ability to be able to weather the stressors of life. We're not making them softer. We're making them tougher.
Strong way to finish the hour. Thank you, Melanie Funches, who is the event. I'm sorry, I just gave you Christina's title. Melanie's Director of Community Engagement.
Fun.
Director of Community Engagement for the Mental Health Association of Rochester. It is always good to see you. Thank you for being here, Melanie.
Thank you.
Christina Mosgraber, Events Coordinator and Walk Manager for NAMI Rochester. Thank you, Christina. Thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Desiree Pernicelsi from Grease Olympia High School. Desiree, thank you for being
thank
here
you
as well.
Thank you very much.
And Christina and Mel, real quick here, if people want resources, want to contact, where to do that?
You can contact NAMI Rochester 585-423-1593 or NAMI, NAMIROC.org.
Mel.
Mental Health Association 585-325-3145 or MHARochester.org, or also hit us up on Facebook, MHA Rochester on Facebook.
Very good. Thank you. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for all the great feedback both hours today. We're right back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.